Hey, welcome inside the MTOM Show podcast room here at the studios of Iowa PBS. Hold on, I got to get my prop. It's a prop. I'm just going to do some reading. This is called Beth the Farm, and it is by Beth Hoffman. And Beth is somebody who grew up in the East, lived in the West, worked as a journalist covering agriculture, was a professor teaching reporting, and now she's a farmer in Iowa. Well, how did that all come about? Well, a lot about her husband, John, her relatives here in Iowa, or at least in-laws, and how the land came about to be in, well, I won't say possession because I don't own it, but how it became they are the operators of this land. We are going to cover a lot of ground. Yeah, I guess that's a pun I could use. We're going to discuss sustainability, organics, plans, wild, crazy ideas, farm transitions. Some of these thoughts might be considered very Pollyanna-ish. She admits that there's a couple of times in the book that it might be naive to think a certain way. But when you hear Beth talk and read what she has written, you'll know that she has done her research and her homework about what it means to be a farmer in Iowa, and how she wants to be one. It's a little different than the traditional way of thinking. Feedback, always welcome, paul.yeager@iowapbs.org. But now let's have our conversation with Beth Hoffman. I did everything in my power today to not start the conversation about the weather, because A, I'm an Iowan, B, I'm involved in agriculture. It's hard to not talk about those two things. Does every Iowan talk about the weather and agriculture with
that,
you as an opener?
That has been my experience, yes. And not being from here, it's noticeable, right, that it's always the weather.
East Coast person, right?
Yes.
And then lived in the West Coast.
Yes.
What's the difference between, let's leave out the Midwest, what's the difference between East and West?
It's a good question. I would say a little bit. But, oh, this will be very unpopular in San Francisco, but I'm going to say arts. Like, the arts in the East Coast feel a lot more vibrant than in the West Coast. It's probably heresy to some people, but, and, you know, New York, the Northeast, well, I wouldn't say all of the Northeast, but the New York area is certainly more direct than anywhere else in the country.
I go back to people. Are the people different?
Not so much anymore. I think because people are from everywhere now, you know, and so there's so many transplants. Yeah, so we're kind of a hodgepodge of people no matter where you go. But a little bit more rushed in New York, but I would say the same, you know, when you're on the bridge and getting to San Francisco and you're sitting in traffic, you're just as aggravated as sitting on the George Washington Bridge.
Well, the Bay Bridge is beautiful, and everybody knows about the Golden Gate.
Yes, I mean, but it might have an earthquake at any moment.
You just never know.
Right.
And so if you can even see because of the whole fog thing.
Correct.
The time I've been over the Golden Gate, I couldn't see because it was foggy that day.
Yes.
So I missed my good view.
Exactly. Although that happens less and less now. We have less fog.
Really?
Much less fog.
That's probably another discussion for another
time, another
day,
yeah.
So when you went to – did you always think journalism was something you wanted to do?
I always wanted to write. So even as a little kid, I was, you know, excited about writing. I didn't know exactly what that was. But then I went and I was a school teacher, an elementary school teacher, sixth grade, gifted and talented. A lot of fun. But I kind of was always in the back of my head thinking, like, this isn't the dream job, that I was going to be a writer.
So I missed this whole elementary teacher side. So elementary teacher to journalist to professor to now farmer. So did, at one point, did little Beth ever think she would do any of those last two, professor and farmer?
Yeah, my dad was a school teacher, so that was maybe in my DNA a little bit, and I always loved bossing people around, if not teaching them something. So teacher wasn't out of the question, but farmer certainly was never in the range of possibility.
How did you get to journalism professor, and at what point did you meet your husband?
So after, so I was elementary school teacher, then journalist, And then I really wanted to teach journalism. So that's where then I went back and got my master's in order to teach. So that was my I walked around, you know, in journalism school saying I'm here because I want to teach. And so when the call came, hey, we're looking for a professor, that was I was the clear person mm-hmm. that they were going to recommend. And so when I went to grad school, when I moved to California, I met my husband, my now husband, within a week or so of moving there. He's my neighbor.
So I have two good friends in California that have been there for almost 20 years. And of everybody that they've met and had any type of relationship with, the woman is always like, when are you going to move me back to Iowa? At what point are we going to leave Los Angeles and go back to Iowa? That ever a conversation that John had with you, or you had fear of, and I do use the word fear at first, of, oh, he's going to want to move me back to Iowa.
Oh, yeah. He made that clear the first minute I met him. He had just been here and visiting the farm, and he walked out, and we met, and he said, oh, I was just visiting the farm. I'm going to move back there. And so it was on the table as soon as we met. And because I was reporting on food and agriculture, we started visiting the farm more and more. And so it wasn't out of the realm of possibility, but I also kind of knew in the back of my mind that he was going, whether it was with me or without me. And so even though he will claim that's not the truth, but so I knew that it was something we either had to make what we wanted it to be, mm-hmm. or it would be really very haphazard, which it was somewhere in the middle. Yeah. It was pretty haphazard. Yeah. But
it's the way relationships can be sometimes. So when you're trying to make careers work in a dual career world, it's different than what, say, maybe John's family was used to. Leroy, mm-hmm. His wife had already passed. Had you met her?
Yes.
So, but did she work off the farm?
No.
So she worked on the farm, and that was kind of the way it was.
In the
right?
house, she didn't. But I mean, everybody in the household, worked on the farm,
and they contributed to the farm. Yes. I'm not saying that they didn't work.
Correct.
Yeah, but it's a thing. At what point did the? I think it's time to have the discussion. Let alone we're going to move.
As the kids, one was out of high school, the other one was nearing the end of high school, and so it became, you know, that was always the mile mark was mm-hmm. like when the kids are out of school. And so we started having that conversation, with Leroy about how that transition might actually work, because as many of your listeners know, it's a very difficult thing, as you know, mm-hmm. a very difficult thing to transition the farm and figure out how is the next generation going to be there when all of the value of the farm is in the farm. There is no 401k sitting there waiting for Leroy to go play golf in Florida. We have a lease with him so that he can afford to live comfortably in his golden years.
Transition is one thing. Transition to something non-traditional or what he was used to was a whole nother. Do you think that the biggest friction at first was that it wasn't the transition, it was the transition to what you and John had in your mind?
Well, I think it's both, you know, because that handing over of power and being in a position where you've been in control of something, whatever it is, for 50 years, and all of a sudden you're going to take a back seat is very scary, I think, you know, to anybody. But yes, us doing something different, and especially me never having been living on a farm, having a good job somewhere else, was this actually going to even happen? Let alone like what we were proposing to actually do. So, you know, I talk about in the book where he started asking us about what we were going to do. And I said, I don't, you know, organics and, you know, some very innocent things like organics and food grade grains. And he went out and got this hoe that had been left, you know, it was like maybe an inch was left on it. And he said, this is what organics is, you know. Do you understand? Do you want to be laboring, battling weeds every day of your life? And yeah, I was taken back because did I really want to be battling weeds every day of my life? You know, that was not something I probably actually wanted to do. But of course, that's mm-hmm. not what organics really is anymore.
Right. So. And but again, it's that transitional, generational view of a topic and the way someone comes from, this is the way I've done it.
Yes.
And I think this is what you're talking about. But in reality, we're somewhere in between.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the transition part because we're coming into the holidays. We've had past episodes where we've talked about having that conversation about the transition. Is the holidays a good time to, Mom, when do you think you're going to leave the farm? Or Dad, you done?
Yeah.
I mean, how did you approach it and how would you do it differently now?
It's a very difficult conversation. And I think part of the problem is that nobody's that clear about what the legacy, where they talk about that a lot in transition, you know, when you go to a workshop, let's say, and you're like, let's get the legacy and what you want this farm to be down. And I think particularly when it's been a commodity growing farm, you function in such a year-to-year fashion, first off. And second of all, like you haven't built a brand or something. The farm isn't an entity that is worth value or has a vision outside of like its corn suitability rating for the land. Mm-hmm. And so there is no vision. There is no like, what do we want in 10 years versus, you know, like let alone 100 years from now. And I think that is really where a family, you could have that conversation on just like, you know, in 100 years from now, what would we want this to look like? And just having people, you know, discuss it in a way that's maybe not like, are you done? I'm going to come. Are we ready to switch hands now? I'm ready to take mm-hmm. over. But what do we all want this to be? And maybe there's not, then at least you would know, is there consensus in this group of people? Have we never even thought about it? Is it, or are we on completely different pages? Because that's important to know where you're starting.
And you're bridging gaps of people who are on and off the farm, out of the city, out of the state, maybe in some cases out of the country, but everybody's entitled to the same share. So sometimes you have to have coalition before you can go to the patriarch or matriarch of the family.
Yeah. I mean, I heard a story in my reporting time. I covered transition a bit. And there was a story about a guy who was 65 who had worked on the farm with his dad for 40 years or something at that point. The parents passed away and all the other siblings wanted to sell the farm. And he was just out of a job at 65 years old because he was the only one who wanted to keep the farm and couldn't afford to buy it for market rate. So yes, you have to build some kind of consensus, but also I think it's important to be questioning, like a lot of families just want to hold on to the land, period, full stop. Like we just want the farm. Why do we want the farm? Like what is that, you know, could you keep 2 acres and have a cabin? And be able to go out there and have memories about what that was like, and then allow the land to transition to somebody who wants to be on it and farm it and care for it. Because in this state, in Iowa, we have more than 50% of the land is now rented out. Mm-hmm. Most of that on 1-year leases. Why is the person who's renting the land going to care about how much fertilizer erodes off of the land or how much chemical, you know, input is affecting the bird life on the farm? It's just they don't, you know, if you really care about the land, maybe keeping it is not the best thing for it.
Go back into the farm discussion of the renter. You covered a lot of, there's a lot of charts and graphs of studies about the things you just mentioned, but I think of a renter who they're looking to find the next 100 or 80 or 160 to try to spread out some of their major investment that they have. I mean, we have plenty of people in this country engaged in agriculture who are, they have a lot of nice new equipment that they have to figure out a way to pay for.
Yes.
And that's, I think you, there was a term you called it the treadmill effect.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
So, you know, it's used the agricultural treadmill, meaning that in order to stay current in order to get those yields that we are told is the way of farming. You have to invest in the best equipment. You have to spend the money on the seeds, the sprays. And so all of that is done through taking out more money, loans, debt. And so the cycle kind of continues on and on because you consistently owe money while you're trying to make some money. And so as John's mom explained it to me, you know, even in the good years where they did well, the money is just poured back into paying off what was already owned or buying that new thing to stay relevant. Mm-hmm. So it just, it spirals on and on.
So do you think Leroy was in the treadmill?
That by Lynn, has the John's mom's account, yes, that's what she called it on her own. We were on a hamster wheel.
Now, granted, you're only 2 years in. Do you feel that you're on a treadmill?
I don't, because we've chosen a different form of agriculture, I think, where that's not, it's not the way things are done. You know, we're not in debt. We are not just making money to cover what we spent already, and we are really focused on this idea of having a brand, also of having the farm and what we do have value outside of just our crops as well. So, and we raise grass-finished beef. So that system kind of is like a parallel alternative universe to the commodity world where you're on that cycle and you're just, it's all about the price this year. Like, we get to set our price. That's a very different thing from having corn and watching the markets and trying to sell at just that right moment so that you can maximize, you know, because the market tells you what it's owned, the market tells you what the value of your crop is, right? We get to tell our customers, this is how much it costs. And that's a very different kind of business model altogether.
You're considered a family farm. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, more than 90% of the farms are considered family farms.
Correct. 98, I think it is.
It's a ridiculous number. Mm-hmm. But your farm is different in many different ways. Mm-hmm. What percentage of farmers do you think are like you and John in your setup?
In Iowa?
We could start at Iowa, but nationally.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think, yes, that term family farm is used to somehow, it has these connotations of small, diversified, like caring for the land, stewards of the land. And you're right, like 98% of farms are family farms, quote unquote, according to the USDA. So they can mean anything. They do anything. They do everything. You know, everything that farmers are doing, they're doing as a family. So I think that in Iowa, you know, I think there's increasing interest in doing things differently. I wouldn't be able to quantify and say 10% or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, 5% or even 20%. Like, I think there's a growing interest in expanding the options. And for me, that's what this is all about, is just not saying nobody grow corn anymore. Let's switch everything. It's just, we need more options. We need to be able to add things onto our farms and be able to diversify what we're all doing.
Well, I was setting you up to ask you that question, basically, is what happens if we switch and flip it around to 95% are the way you are, of the sustainable, much smaller, we set our price, we don't have an incredible amount of debt. And there's only 5% of the farms growing all these corn and soybeans and wheat and cotton and all these large commodities. Do we have room? What happens if we flip?
I don't know. That sounds pretty ideal, doesn't it?
You could argue that there's a lot of people in your book that would probably argue against that because they would lose.
Well, they would lose what?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of large commodity support groups, whether it's the National Corn Growers or the American Soybean Association, the Farm Bureau. they have a lobby that is interested in
bigger is better.
And there's other groups that don't have that view.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you asked the average American, whatever that means, you just stopped any random person on the street, really anywhere in this country, rural, urban, anywhere in between, And you said, what is the ideal farm? And what does that look like? And what's our ideal rural communities? Like, what do you want in a small town? It would be that there's human beings in it, that it has some vibrant commerce, right? We have schools that have kids in them, and churches that have, you know, attendees. And I think that that means, by definition, that we have more people on the farms, that we have smaller farms doing more diversified things. And I think as we look at how this nation is going to handle climate change in an environment where, you know, currently 90% of our fruits and vegetables come from California. If California is not our breadbasket, if it is too dry and too hot and potentially on fire, sadly, where's our food coming from? I mean, when I first came to this state and I was driving around with John, I said, like, if something dramatic happened, right, we had a pandemic that stopped our food supply chains, right, there's really nothing to eat in this state. And it's a sad fact of, like, this is some of the most fertile soils in the world. We have great potential to grow lots of other things. Why not do that? Why not have those options for farmers where you could have apple, like some of the apples we're getting from the Iowa Food Co-op, from farms in Iowa, are some of the best apples I've ever had. This was a very vibrant apple growing state. It's not anymore. Why not? Why not have that?
Well, we have a climate that December, it's cold this morning, mm-hmm. January, February, March, where we don't really grow much. Mm-hmm. That would change our shopping habits. I want to go in and get a tomato, a pepper, a mango, a pineapple any day of the year when I walk into my big grocery store.
Do you eat tomatoes year-round?
Do I eat tomatoes year-round?
Yeah.
I like them in eggs in the morning, I don't. I mean, I grow some, but I don't have to have tomatoes. My mother just told me last week, she goes, oh, I love tomatoes. I could eat them every day. And I'm like, I just can't. But we have grown to like certain foods, almost have that option every time we go to the store.
We like the idea of having that option. I think that, I mean, my eating habits change over the course of years. I think that a lot of people do. Like, I don't eat peaches in December. And I'm okay with that. Actually, I saw plums in the store like recently, and I was like, who's buying them? Like, is there that big of a market for that? I think we're okay with some variability. And I'm also not advocating that we don't have, you know, a vibrant global commerce, that we don't have things coming from places like Florida or California. I just think that to rely on that for 90% of our food opens us up to food insecurity. It shows in this food supply chain and the pandemic, it clearly showed that there were lots of problems. It still are, right? Now we just can't get everything we want at any time we want. Well, that might be, you know, what is the future, which I think we should plan for today.
I just took my 12-year-old for his well-child checkup this week, and on the wall, it's about, you know, how many fruits and vegetables did he eat? His fruits and vegetables might look different if we were still on the farm the way I grew up or my parents grew up, where things were canned. It might not be as fresh, but I'm going to get my vegetables one way or another. But what about my meat situation? I can get meat any time of year. You found out in the meat situation, you talk about the pandemic, that you were trying to find places for your animals to go. At the same time, so was everybody else, because the big four were not taking animals.
Right.
Well,
right.
Talk about the challenge, your livestock, and finding a place to get them processed.
Yeah. So direct marketing beef, you know, like we said, it's we can set our price and we can say to consumers, here's how much this costs, and this is what we need to make per pound, because this is how much it costs us to grow. that's a wonderful process, but you have to have places to have the processing done in order to be able to have that happen with consumers. And you're right. When we first, we were coming into a time where we had cattle that were ready, and we were like, let's call the local locker and get this done in the next, 2 months or whatever. We were calling ahead. And we realized at that moment, we actually wrote to Story City, which mm-hmm. is, a wonderful asset in the state, and said, okay, we're starting this process. Where do we find someone who will work with us in this region and, who's the best? And he was like, oh, you need to call, good luck for finding someone in 2021. This was 2020 at the time. And
you're talking like in May?
We were calling these calls.
So we're a couple of months into the pandemic.
Yes, a couple months in. And yes, it was like we called around and they were booked over a year out. And I've just heard about that still now. Most places like right now are booking for 2023. Which doesn't really work for anybody, even the meat lockers, because how do the farmers actually know what they have ready, 2 years or a year and a half from now? It's a very difficult thing, because then you end up having cancellations. And so it's kind of a long story, and I talk in the book a lot about, the whole book. It has charts and graphs, but it's mostly our story to talk about all of these issues. And the end of the story, really, that's not in the book, is that now we work with the Milo Locker. They book just 6 months out, so I think that guarantees that they're actually going to have the cattle that says they're coming in when they're coming in, and it works for them. It's working for us quite well, and so it's working out currently for us, although we just realized yesterday that we might have a lot more cattle. The where we thought we would sell some wholesale is maybe not going to work out. So, yeah, what do we do with 9 more in a year when nobody has a space? We're going to have to figure that out.
You're dealing with 9 extra, and some farmers are dealing with 90
extra
cows.
Yep.
But it's no less a stress for you than it is for somebody else.
Yeah.
What are you finding in these? Do you find that the Milo lockers, the Story City, I mean, are they expanding? Do you think that they're going to? I mean, we've reported on it on Market to Market about the challenges, and they're trying to expand, and there's been legislation to help them expand.
Yes.
Is that going to be an answer for the meat industry as a whole?
Well, we just heard that the Moravia locker, which is near us, is expanding, which would be great too. They deal with a lot of deer also in there. So having more space for different kinds of animals will help. But I think it's going to boil down to an employment problem. Excuse me. That I don't know how we're going to find a lot more people to get into that field. It's a very difficult thing to work mm-hmm. in a cold room, every
day. It's hard work.
It's hard work.
I mean,
it's
just
very
like,
hard work.
Just like the stories of those in the meatpacking plants themselves, the large ones, it's hard work for them.
Yes.
I mean, there's plenty of books been written about for decades, almost a century, the meat, and it hasn't really changed. And yes, there's been safety measures, but it is a hard job.
Right. And, I think the pay levels, I think JBS in Ottumwa pays something in the $22 an hour range, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's decent money. It's not minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So, I think that then attracting someone to come to a smaller locker, I think there's probably a lot of benefits about that, to work in a smaller place where you're not just kind of on a conveyor belt of, work. You're doing something that's a bit more artisanal. You're getting to slow down. You don't do the same movements 1,000 times, 10,000 times a day. So I think there'll be a lot of benefits to it. But, of course, all of these problems are interwoven with other huge problems like, housing. Where would people live,
Housing. Mm-hmm. That is an issue pre-pandemic. I would say go back to at least 2018, if not 17. I had a conversation with a rural Iowa banker. I asked, what's the biggest concern? And he was in a town of, I don't know, that town's about 1,000, 3,000 people. And he says, housing. I need more housing. your idea of the farm, of having someone come in and maybe work and share and build, maybe if you could figure out a way to build housing, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you become a developer. And why is housing such a big issue in your mind?
Well, I think that if you're going to farm, you want to live the lifestyle of what that, you know, either the ideal or, you know, you want to have that reality of living on the farm mm-hmm. or at least nearby the farm. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to commute to your job as a farmer. It's kind of not, it's not only, you know, it's not idealistic and it's not reality, because there's a lot of times where you just get that call that the cows are out and you got to go deal with the cows being out and you're 30 minutes away or whatever your commute is. That's a very stressful kind of thing to do. So it's very important, and I think that a lot of groups like the Sustainable Iowa Land Trust, they have found that in trying to get new people to come onto land, like they work with landowners to put land into an easement, conservation easements, but then also to donate the land to SILT, and then they find people to come onto the land to farm it and grow food crops is a big part of that. So in order to do that, in order to find somebody to grow whatever on your property, there has to be a place to live there. Otherwise, it's really a very difficult thing to convince people to come.
You mentioned a chicken and egg argument, a couple of them. This is one of them, because who are you going to find as a developer in a town to say, I need you to build two or three houses? Maybe not in town, maybe one or two in town, but build one on some random spot in the country. Who's going to do that? And if you do it, you're saying that's a possibility. We can draw some more people back into smaller towns.
Yeah, I think that, you know, especially when you're talking about entry level, like people who are not, I mean, I think there's a market for building kind of a nice house in the country and people coming out there and then, but not being farmers necessarily. So I think that that's the problem when we're talking about affordable housing and housing where people can get a start with a family and live near the farm or on the farm. Those are two different kinds of things.
Okay. Do you see, is that going to have to be led organically or led governmentally, policy?
Well, I think it's just it's going to have to be what landowners do, because otherwise you can't find people to come to your land. So it kind of depends on, I think we need to have some of these like long range, really kind of thinking about as a nation, like mm-hmm. what do we want in rural America? What do we want in our rural towns and communities? How do we want them to look? And then we have to invest in that to get to where we want mm-hmm. to be. Because as we well know, a lot of towns have been gutted over the last, you know, what's it now, 40-ish years since the 80s, when so many people lost their farms, left farm country altogether. It's not as vibrant. There's not as many kids in school. There's not as many shops on Main Street. And if that's the vision of what we want, we have to make it so.
Do you find, though, that the ability to commute better, cars are more efficient, the internet in some places is better and allows us to work remotely or, I guess those are two opposite things, but do you find that the ability for us to move and find work has also contributed to the problem, but also helped the problem?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you see towns like during the pandemic, there's all these stories in the Wall Street Journal of towns incentivizing people to move there, work remotely from our town, you know, live in wherever, anywhere rurally. The key to that is broadband. And so, you know, I've been actually this new announcement that there's broadband monies. I've been trying to find somebody to come for, I'm on the board of the Farmers Union, the Iowa Farmers Union, to have somebody come and talk about how do communities apply for these monies, and no one's returning any emails. So it seems very like, it's something that there's knowledge that this is a problem, but the real like, push out of how it works, who's in charge, how do people apply. I think that has to be much more transparent.
Did you ever get frustrated as a reporter when you'd call someone and they wouldn't call you back for the story? Do you feel that any of that is the same now?
Oh, it's definitely the same, yeah. But you always just follow up, right? And then most of the time people say, oh, I meant to call you back, but...
I don't know. It was towards the end of the book you referenced you had called and called and called because some of your paperwork had been held up. And you were able to, you finally, well, who's making that decision? Let me call, basically, can I talk to your supervisor? You pulled a Karen on him right there and said, can I talk to your manager? But that's sometimes what's needed to get attention.
Yeah, I think it's we, you know, humans make rules, made the rules. Humans can unmake the rules. We have to make them so that they actually work. And I think that, you know, if I was to say, I've been asked this many times now, you know, what's some of the solutions? What should we ask for policy-wise? And I think that, you know, just like you'd have a doctor to supervise like all these different prescriptions you might be taking and how they might function with each other. And are some of these drugs, you know, doing the opposite of what other ones are trying to promote in your body? We need to have that kind of assessment of what's going on in the USDA because there are many programs that seem to be at odds with mm-hmm. others and departments working in opposite, like literal opposite objectives, and kind of it's like we're standing in place, we're just jogging in place when we can be moving ahead.
Well, you're finding that at a lot of turns, there's some of all of this bureaucracy is set up to do a certain way of agriculture or a certain way.
Yes.
How do you get, I won't ask the magic question, but how do you get, I mean, those people you mentioned, they're all doing good work, they're trying their best.
Yes.
But they're so far down the chain that they just don't get that attention. How do you help those agencies help others?
Well, I think, you know, there's one argument that says top down, right? We need to change the policies in this country, which that's some place to start, for example, is looking at where they're working at odds with each other. But there's also a great argument to be made from the bottom up. So if things are not working, like we've just had an experience with the NRCS again, that it's like, why is it that way? And actually asking the questions up the chain and trying to get some actual answers is really needed. It's not... I mean, you asked about the cultural differences, East Coast, West Coast, but it's more like, you know, now the East Coast part of me says, you know, agitate, ask questions, keep going up the chain, figure out what's going on. Like, we have to participate in our own government. It can't just be like a runaway train that we're on. We have to actually activate, you know, and ask the questions and not just maybe Iowa Nice all the time.
What's the town you live closest to?
La Villa.
La Villa. And you mentioned they are down to not even a restaurant now, or is it
there
operational?
There is. We have, yeah.
So you had some grand visions for that. From the time you finished the book to now, do you still see that as a possibility?
Yeah, we talked about, you know, and I wrote in our blog about this whole vision about having a shop and a little restaurant in town. And it was probably the blog post where I got the most feedback from people just being like, yes, do it. This is so exciting. Again, it's our image of what we'd love rural towns to be like, to have this little center of, you know, where people get together, where you could actually go and have coffee because that's gone in our community. It's morphed a little bit. Our current plan is to actually build a commercial kitchen on the farm and have people be able to come out to the farm and take cooking classes and maybe rent it out to do their own small batch, you know, jams or breads or whatever, and be able to sell it legally and in shops. That's it's morphed a little bit because we don't need as many people involved in that. Like, to run a restaurant and a shop, it's a beautiful vision. But at 53, do we both want to work full time on the farm, be writing, be doing marketing, and running a restaurant? You know, it's not possible probably with two human beings.
No, it's not. And is it realistic or fair to yourself? I mean, yes, you don't want it to be a hobby. It is a business.
Right.
And people put tons of work into their business, and you're doing the same. What would you say has been the hardest part? Not throw it. You have to take the pandemic out, but you can, I know. What's been the hardest part in 2 years here for you?
I think for me, personally, and coming as a total rookie, this is like a rookie, the hardest thing as a rookie, is working with animals is a really challenging thing. And you can see why so many farms have moved away from livestock, because they're these living beings that are depending upon you to keep them safe, to keep them well nourished, to keep them healthy. And for me, that's probably the most challenging, just on a kind of a psychological level, like not, again, as a rookie, not knowing what animals need in the same way that John does, because he's grown up around them. So I anthropomorphize them. I kind of think of them in storms and like, oh, what are the cows doing? You know, and it's a very, I think that well-seasoned ranchers do not have that same, you know, sitting up at night worrying about their goats in the storm. So that's the rookie part of it. I think on a farm level, though, it's just it's challenging when you're not doing the mainstream thing that you have to then invent your own wheel half the time. You know, just figure out, okay, we want to grow this grain. Who can deal with this grain? Where do we bring this grain in order so that, you know, it can be purchased, it can get to customers? Those are really difficult challenges. And luckily there's some groups, you know, like the Practical Farmers of Iowa, who are there where we can ask each other questions. It's a very vibrant kind of community feel where farmers help farmers in those environments.
You mentioned that group, and that was part of your discussion of they are helping each other. And you also discussed this part of we shouldn't see our neighbors as our competitors. We talk amongst ourselves as producers on the show of so many times people think of their neighbor as their competitor, but their neighbor is usually in an entirely different situation because let's go back to debt level or age of the farm or what decision or what type of seed. So in some sense, their neighbor really isn't their competitor even if they think they are because everybody's different.
Yeah.
But is it a little Pollyanna-ish to think we can all work together and it's all going to be great and we're all going to make money because we can set our price?
Yeah, I mean, well, first off, I would say that it is interesting, isn't it, the language that's used in agriculture, how so much of it is warlike. It's like we're winning the battle, you know, and you know, beating your competitor. And it's very curious language when you think about it, that at the same time, like, yes, our neighbor might have a different debt level or different age, but they also are growing the exact same thing that we are. And we all are in the same boat of needing a certain price to cover our production costs. So, you know, yes, it's Pollyanna-ish, but if you look at actual research about how humans interact and when they work together, it benefits everyone involved more than the competition very often. So it's something that is like if our neighbor and I were sort of thinking about things like we're in the same boat, we use the same equipment, we sell to the same market, we sell to the same elevator, you know, it's if we thought about it that way, there might be many more ways that we could actually work together to lower our costs, right? We could ship things together. We could use some of the same equipment. We could have everything sprayed at the same time would probably lower everybody's costs, right? So there's all of these places where you could think about it. If we worked in tandem together, we could actually have a lot more power. And, you know, the ultimate of that would be that if we had groups advocating for farmers in the marketplace, and that we were thinking about the price together and the supply and how those two things interact, right? If we have oversupply, if all of our, if what we're going for, everybody is like beating the yields of everybody else, we drive down the price. So back to your question about what if only 5% of people were growing corn, they would get a lot better market price than they do when 100% of people are growing corn.
It's a constant discussion point that we have on the show. Mm-hmm. During the market analysis segment is, all right, do farmers head fake each other of, oh, yeah, I'm going to tell USDA I'm going to plant a bunch of corn. And then in reality, I'm going to go plant beans instead because they're trying to trick the market. But in all reality, is a 1,000 to 10,000 acre farmer in the middle of Indiana, Iowa, or Illinois really going to make a difference on the market? Probably not.
Right, right.
And it hasn't, and you never have.
Correct. And like who... Who are the, I mean, I just think that farmers really have to think closely about who's representing them in setting legislation and setting policy and thinking about government programs. Who's representing them and what are they advocating for? Is it in your best interest at the end of the day?
But it's what we've always done. I have to do it this way.
Maybe. And I mean, there's lots of things. I brush my teeth the same way every day because I've always done it that way, right? But we can make changes. We have that capability of making changes. And you can see it at a group like PFI, the Practical Farmers of Iowa, where it's not a political group or they're not advocating for particular things even. It's like everybody's there just to learn how to do something a little bit different. And you end up with people who are just at the convention like to learn how to put in cover crops. And what are the costs of that? And how do I manage that? That's all they're there to learn. And somebody else next door is there to hear about organic vegetable markets. You know, it's like that's where you see farmers working together and sharing information. It doesn't need to be a battle. We don't need to have our, you know, big guns out in this experience.
Back to the war reference you go. All right. Give your elevator speech on the book on why it was why it's something that we should read.
Well, I think one of the reasons why I wrote the book is that I think there's a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions about farmers. And I really wanted to write a book that was fair to farmers and really talked about the reasons why people choose what they do. Why do we do what we do? Because it was always a back of my mind kind of question when I did reporting about sustainable agriculture or read things. It's like, if everything is so great, why aren't we all doing it? So I wanted to get down to the reasons why, A, that wasn't happening more potentially, and what's happening with, like, why do people grow corn if you're not making any money, right? So I wanted to understand those reasons, and I think that going forward in this world, if we look at the climate, if we look at, you know, world politics, whatever, change, you know, and volatility is here to stay. And so we have to start planning for the future today. Our future is here. And if we don't make solutions that address the actual problems, we're going to get nowhere. So I just find that what I really wanted to do in the book is kind of give an insider view through story. Like, it's not like it's not a textbook, this book. I wanted to use story to talk about why we do what we do.
Bet the Farm is the name of the book. What's the sequel going to be called? Are we just worried about the first one right now?
One thing at a time, yeah.
And the name of the farm, and would you change the name?
Our farm's name is Whippoorwill Creek Farm.
And is it still
very lengthy. Yeah. It's tricky. It's got so many different double letters going on in there. But we named it that, and there's a beautiful blog post my husband wrote about. It's not only the Whippoorwill Creek comes through the farm, A, but B, he remembers in the 80s hearing whippoorwills, and at one point hearing a whippoorwill cry and cry and cry and cry and never found a mate, and there were no more whippoorwills. And so we are aiming to have them back and have an environment on the farm that's much more healthy.
All right. Beth Hoffman, thank you so very much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
My thanks to Beth Hoffman for her time. The book is called Bet the Farm, and you can get it wherever books are sold. Feedback, hit me up, markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Thank you so much for taking time to listen to this conversation. We'll see you next time.